What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, do you know the best way to eliciting the best answer?
Aha, good question.
Thank you, John.
A beautiful question.
It all starts there. And, you know, we remember the Shell Answer Man. And so we always like people in America who have all the answers. You know, there's a wise soul, and let's go to him. He's got all the answers. But Warren Berger, who's written books on questions, the latest of which is The Book of Beautiful Questions, tells us that a lot of the breakthroughs, a lot of the things that really reveal new truths start with a really great question. Doesn't that make sense?
No, that makes sense. I mean, you proof it each time you come to the microphone.
Thank you, John. Thank you. I think you're being just solicitous. John, why are you being solicitous? I'm asking you that question. No, but seriously, lines of inquiry, innocent, well-informed, maybe coming out of the babes' mouths. I mean, this is how so many fascinating breakthroughs in our culture have taken place.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, which brings me to a point I'm thinking about is how you phrase your question can also get you the answer that you may be looking for. So to get to the point.
And when you think about it, John, there are so many professions in America that really are about questioning. I mean, a scientist is in the lab always asking really hard questions, one to the other. What are we doing? What are we looking at here? You know, have we not really thought about this angle or that angle to our scientific experiment? Then you've got detectives. Think about it. They're sitting there pondering. They've got all those notes on the board we see in Law and Order.
That's right.
And how did this all come together?
I was thinking of Joe Friday.
Yeah, what are we missing, John? What are we missing? There's some piece of evidence that we're missing. And then think about it, our doctors, if they don't ask the right questions, they may never find out what's going on with us because we're not likely to reveal it.
We don't want to give them any hints. Come on.
And then, what have we been hearing about lately? Well, when you go in and you're asked a question by the prosecutor, Robert Mueller, or whatever it may be, they know exactly what you've done. They've got evidence, so you better have the right answer. You better not lie because they know they're expert at asking questions. We're talking about lawyers.
Right.
And then, of course, talk show hosts or podcast hosts.
Sure.
So there are so many of us in the business of asking questions.
Wow, I never thought about that. And we were worried about the answer man.
Absolutely. Well, let's get on to Warren Berger. He's a fascinating guy. And the book is called The Book of Beautiful Questions, the powerful questions that will help you decide, create, connect, and lead, all today on America Trends. With us on the line on America Trends is Warren Berger, and he's got a new book, The Book of Beautiful Questions. And Warren, a lot of people read your first book, A More Beautiful Question, and help us to understand what it is that you're extending in terms of this science of questionology, if you will, in your new book.
Yeah, well, I think of the first book, A More Beautiful Question, as kind of a general argument in favor of questioning. You know, so it talked about why questioning is important, why we maybe tend to question less than we should, and it also connected questioning to innovation. It showed that questioning was the source of a lot of great breakthroughs and innovations. So that was kind of the focus of the first book. Then, as I was traveling around after the book came out, I noticed that people would ask, you know, what specific questions should I be asking? And they were oftentimes looking at one particular area that they might be in. So what I ended up doing with the second book was I focused on four specific areas that seemed to be coming up a lot when I was going around and talking to people. You know, I noticed that people were really interested in decision making. So can they ask questions to help them make better decisions? They were really interested in creativity. So I focused on, okay, what's the connection between questioning and creativity? Can you ask questions in ways that will help sort of spark your creativity? They were interested in leadership. That's a big, big topic these days. So I focused in on, okay, what's the relationship between questioning and leadership? Are there questions that a leader should be asking? And then the fourth area that I focused on is just interpersonal connections, you know, relationships. So how do you use questioning to, let's say, strengthen your relationships, either with people you already know or maybe people you're just getting to know? What's the role of questioning there? So that's the new book. It's basically, you know, it's kind of like four books in one, but it's basically focusing on those four areas and then bringing questioning into each of those areas.
Well, I've got to tell you how daunting it is as somebody who's been a questioner of so many people over time as a radio personality and now doing a podcast to interview somebody who really is an expert at questionology in this new area. Maybe I should have you interview yourself.
I don't know. I think I prefer to have others ask the questions. I tend to like to gather questions myself. You know, that's my role now. I kind of go around and I look for what is a great question, what makes it a great question, and you know, I sort of feel like that's my role now, is to sort of find all these great questions, figure out what makes them good questions, and then you know, put them out there into the world.
Well, we all remember in philosophy where somebody said, here's the question at the end of an exam period, why? Mm-hmm. And then the answer, mm-hmm. why not?
I mean, exactly.
Is it as simple as that, or as alluring as that? Is a good question one that's closed-ended or open-ended?
It could be either one. It depends on what you're trying to do. You know, open-ended questions, as the word suggests, they kind of open things up. They open up possibilities. So when you ask an open-ended question, it can't be answered in a definitive way, like yes or no, you know, the way a classic closed question is a yes or no question, or a closed question might also be a factual question, you know, what time does the meeting start? Well, there's only one answer, you know, 9 o'clock is the answer, you know. So there are times when closed questions are very useful, you know, when you need to get a specific answer to something. A closed question leaves little doubt about what you're looking for. You know, you want this specific yes or no. You want the fact. So that's the role of the closed question. If you want to generate discussion and exploration and you want to open up more possibilities, then that's where open questions become important. So I just think it's a situational thing. But I do think, you know, I tend to lean towards open questions. You know, I find them more interesting. I find that they will open up a conversation in a way that closed questions don't. You know, closed questions will sometimes shut down a conversation.
Oh, absolutely. I've got to believe, though, that your favorite game show is Jeopardy.
Exactly, because the questions get to be the star. The questions suddenly become the answer.
Well, exactly. And, but when you think of America, I mean, we like to think that we have a lot of answers. I remember that one of the great ad campaigns of all time was the Shell Answer Man. So in America, do we respond more to the questions or to somebody who can provide the answers?
Well, I think historically and traditionally, we've placed a lot of emphasis on answers. And I think, you know, that makes sense. I understand that. You know, the leader in the past, the leader was supposed to be the person who had all the answers. And we could look to that leader to more or less guide us or tell us what to do. I think we're entering a different world now. I think, or we're in a different world now. I don't think we're entering anymore. We're in it. And I think what's happened is the world has gotten more complex. We've grown up a little as people, And we realize it's not so simple. You know, it's not, there aren't easy answers to everything. There isn't a person who has all the answers who is going to tell us exactly what to do. If we do look to a person that way, we're liable to get into trouble, you know. So, and if a leader believes they have all the answers, that leader is likely to get into trouble, because it's a failure to acknowledge how complicated things are and how we're in this world now where everything changes all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And things are changing every day. So the idea that you can rest on your answers is kind of foolish, and you're going to get in trouble if you do that. So I think what's going on now that's interesting, we're realizing, okay, if answers are not as reliable as they used to be, if they oftentimes have a shorter shelf life, you know, what used to be an answer, a good answer for my company a couple of years ago doesn't work anymore, you know, so they have a shorter shelf life. Okay, so what that means is answers have become a little less valuable, and questioning has become more valuable, because we're going to have to keep finding new answers, and the only way we're going to keep finding new answers is by asking really good questions, being willing to ask questions.
I agree with you. Interestingly, as you talk about how complicated things are getting or have become, you remind us at the same time that if you really want a good question, go to a four-year-old. And what is it about their curiosity that we need to mimic?
Yeah, the four-year-old is the ultimate questioner. In particular, interestingly, in one of the research studies, they identified not only a four-year-old, but more specifically, a four-year-old girl. A four-year-old girl, they decided, was the ultimate questioning machine, asking as many as, you know, 300 questions a day. So, and of course, the four-year-old boy was not far behind. You know, if the girl was asking 300, the boy was asking 280. But what they're doing, what's going on at that age is just, you know, the brain is hungry. It's in growth mode. We're looking to learn any way we can. And what we have figured out is that, you know, the child has figured out that he or she has a tool for learning that you know, we were all born with, and that it's this ability to ask questions. If we ask questions, we can learn things. We can get people to tell us stuff. So it's, you know, once kids discover they have this tool, and once they see how well it works, they start to use it a lot, right? they start asking lots and lots of questions. And the interesting thing is, you know, at the time they're doing it, it probably drives their parents a little bit crazy, and the parents might be wishing, oh God, you know, I wish this would stop. Now the sad thing is, it does sort of stop, or it declines. You know, as the kid gets to be a little older, 5, 6, 7 years old, the questioning starts this steady decline. And then by the time kids are in junior high or high school, they're questioning a lot less. Sometimes they're just not asking questions at all. So, and one of the things I think about or explore is, you know, what's causing that? What causes that downward trajectory? And I don't think there's one easy answer for that. I think it's probably, you know, 6 or 7 or 10 things all combined. You know, part of it is, a lot of it has to do with just social pressure. You know, as we get older and as we're in school around our peers, we start becoming very conscious of looking cool and seeming smart. And we have this, you know, in our society, we have this idea that if you ask questions, it makes you look like you're not smart. You know, like there's something you don't know. It's a sign of weakness. So I think that gets internalized with kids, and they start to ask less questions, and it continues right through to adulthood. And in adulthood, we're guilty of the same thing. You know, at work, we don't want to ask questions because, what will they think if I ask questions? They might think I don't know my job well enough. So it's a big issue.
Well, I do recall we did a podcast with a psychologist who wrote a book about troublemakers within a company, suggesting that the best group think comes from somebody questioning the logic of the group. However, what she says is do not couch it by saying, well, just to play devil's advocate, because that diminishes what you're about to say. It's a way for you to defend yourself. Well, I don't really necessarily even agree with this idea, but let me put it out there. And so she was saying, be confident, because the troublemakers, and she goes back, of course, to 12 Angry Men, can change the entire dynamic of decision-making, which is something you talk about.
Yeah, I mean it's that willingness to go against the flow, and to ask the question, what if we're not right? What if the thing we're all agreeing on is not right? Shouldn't we step back a minute and consider the other possibilities, or consider the opposite that might be true? So I think the willingness to do that is really important. It's really important in organizations. And I agree with you, by the way. I don't like the devil's advocate framing of a question, because it sort of makes it seem like, oh, I'm just doing this to be, to be contrary. That's the only reason I'm asking this question. I just want to be contrary. And that's not what it's supposed to be about. It's not, you don't ask those why, when you stop the group and you say, why are we doing this? We all seem to be moving in one direction. Why? When you're doing that, you're not doing that just to be contrary. You're doing that because you want to make sure that everyone is not just operating on autopilot, or people are not just following certain assumptions without challenging them or thinking about them. That's the reason you do that. So I think you shouldn't couch it as a devil's advocate thing. You should couch it as, I want to be the person that just makes sure, or that is willing to remind everyone that, we shouldn't just assume things, or we shouldn't just do things this way because that's the way we've been doing them. Every now and then we need to step back and ask really fundamental questions about what we're doing and why we're doing them. And, I'm willing, you say to the group, I'm willing to take on that role. That's a role that requires a little bit of courage. The person who asks those fundamental questions has to have a little bit of fortitude, because sometimes you get laughed at for it.
However, as you point out in the book, and another author pointed out, that's really where innovation comes. Clayton Christensen, in a book that he wrote, and he's that great understander, the person who understands creative disruption and what happens now in corporate America. And in his book recently, and we did have one of his co-authors on with us, he asks one simple question when they start talking about the importance of a product or whatever it is that they're creating. What problem is this product attempting to solve? Because if you can't answer that, then you really shouldn't go forward with the product unless you understand what it is that this product or service is going to help resolve in the lives of everyday people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's... It's true with companies as well as products. I mean, companies have to, every now and then, step back and ask fundamental questions about the reason for that company being there. And, a lot of times companies start with a very clear purpose. They start out because they're trying to solve a problem, or they're trying to fill a need out there in the world that nobody's filling right now. So they start out with a very clear purpose. But then over time, things change and they get a little bit removed from that original purpose they had. And so they have to, every now and then, ask again, why are we here? Who relies on us? Who would miss us if we weren't here? Just to remind yourself of who your customer is. Those kind of basic questions. Another basic question that I find companies have to ask now is, and it's going to sound kind of funny, but they have to ask the question, what business are we in? Because the business they started out in might not be the case anymore. You know, it might be that they started out, if you're Nike, you know, you start out making shoes or athletic shoes, but you look at Nike today and they're a lot more than that. You know, they're not really just making shoes now. They're about a lifestyle. So they're kind of in the lifestyle business. They're not so much in the shoe business anymore. And I think it's happening with lots and lots of companies where over time, their customers are evolving, the market is evolving around them, and they're evolving. And so they need to remind themselves through questioning, hey, who are we? What business are we in? Who are our customers today?
Well, look at Kodak. They got so in love with their chemicals and their processing that they didn't ask that fundamental question that Apple was able to answer, which is, we really want something to capture our memories. We don't care whether you've got the best chemicals or engineers when it comes to photographics.
And that's what it is. I mean, a lot of companies have figured that out. It's not about the technology or it's not about the format you're using. It's about, you know, what is it that you're really delivering? What is the experience you're delivering? And you have to constantly change that and change the way you deliver that. I think, you know, Kodak is kind of a classic example. You see it all the time with companies that just, you know, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier. They found an answer at some point, and they thought they could coast on that answer forever. And what happens in the business world today is you can't coast on an answer very long. You're going to have to come up with a lot of new answers. And that's where the questioning becomes really important. And I think it's something big companies miss, too. Because entrepreneurs get it. You know, entrepreneurs understand about questioning. They're starting with questions, right? Every business almost starts with a question, like, how are we going to solve this problem? You know, and then you're asking questions about, how are we going to set up the business? How are we going to operate? What's going to be our mission? So you're asking all these questions as an entrepreneur. Then what happens is the company gets established, and you feel like, okay, we've answered everything. You know, we've got it all written down. Look at all these programs. Look at these things. We have these manuals that say what our company's all about, right? So we have mission statements. We have all this stuff that sort of has put it all into writing. And then they stop asking questions, right? Because they feel like it's all been answered already. So this is a big challenge now that these bigger companies and established companies are facing. You know, the world has changed. They thought they had figured it all out. They thought they'd figured out a system for running their business. They thought they'd figured out all the products. So they thought they knew who their customer was. Now it's all changed. It's all different. And I'll be honest, you know, I'm meeting with these companies all the time. And, you know, they're in panic mode. It's scary. I mean, I meet with companies that are 100 years old, market leaders, world famous. They're scared. I mean, they don't know what to do next.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, your book, The Book of Beautiful Questions, is your latest, but I want to take you back to Glimmer, one of your earlier books, about how this innovative design thinking is transforming the way we live. And you write about these innovators and entrepreneurs when they realized that one thing they had in common was that they were all very good at asking questions. And you take us back to many great examples. If you'd like to point to one, because I think these concrete examples help people, say Netflix or Polaroid, since we were on the camera kick. If you want to talk about that for just a moment.
Well, Polaroid is an interesting, Polaroid is an interesting case because it started with a question. The business started with a question. And you remember earlier we were talking about the four-year-old and the four-year-old girl, right? Well, Polaroid, interestingly enough, started with a question from a four-year-old girl. And it was the founder of Polaroid was on vacation with his family, including his four-year-old daughter. Polaroid was not in the camera business yet at that point. They were making lenses and optical equipment, and Edwin Land, the founder of the company, was out with his daughter and was taking pictures. Took a picture of his four-year-old daughter, and then, you know, put the camera away. And the daughter was tugging on his sleeve saying, I want to see it. I want to see the picture. And, you know, Edwin Land, this is back in 1943. Edwin Land says, no, well, you know, you can't see the picture because it has to go be sent out and it's going to take a while. They have to make the picture in a lab and all this. And the four-year-old daughter says to him, why do we have to wait for the picture? And that question was the thing that got Edwin Land thinking about instant photography. I mean, he suddenly, it was a question that forced him to step back and reconsider something that was an assumption, right? He was operating on an assumption, and we all were at that time, operating on the assumption that this is how photography worked. You took a picture, and then you sent, you know, you sent the film to a lab, and then in the lab they processed it, they printed it, then after a certain number of days, you got your picture. So this question challenged that assumption. It basically said, does it really have to be that way?
Exactly.
And that's what got Edwin Land thinking, you know, no, maybe it doesn't. You know, maybe you can actually make everything happen right away. And I like to, you know, talk about why, what if, and how questions, mm-hmm. you know. They kind of go in a cycle together. A lot of times in innovation, you kind of start with why, and then you ask what if, and then you ask how. So in the case of Polaroid, the why question was his daughter's question, right? Why do we have to wait for the picture? And then Edwin Land started asking what if and how questions. It's like, okay, what if we could have everything happening right away inside the camera, all the development and the processing and the printing. What if you could basically put a dark room inside a camera? And then he had to figure out, well, how would you do that? You know, how would you create a prototype of that? So that led to the instant camera. And there's just tons of stories like that, you know, that of companies and products where usually starts with a why question. Someone looks at a problem or a situation and says, you know, why does this problem exist? In the case of Netflix, you know, why do we have to go to a video store and rent movies and then get hit with late fees if we don't return them on time? So all of these companies and products, you know, somebody out there was looking at a need or a problem and asking, why hasn't somebody dealt with this issue? And then they go from there. They take ownership of that question, and then they start asking, okay, what if we tried this? What if we tried that? And how are we gonna make it affordable? How do we create a prototype? How do we test it? They take those questions, basically take it all the way to the end.
And you tell us that a question becomes a beautiful question, apropos to the title of your book, when it has the power to bring about change in some material way, and it challenges the way we think about something.
Yes. So going back to the Edwin Land Polaroid question, that was a beautiful question that the four-year-old girl asked. You know, not that she was so sophisticated or anything. She kind of, you know, she was a great natural questioner as a young girl, and she kind of stumbled on a beautiful question, which is, you know, why do we have to wait for the picture? It's a beautiful question because it changed the way Edwin Land thought. And then by changing the way he thought, it ultimately changed the world. So a lot of these questions that lead to breakthroughs, I consider them beautiful questions because they just change someone's thinking. But, you know, the same thing, it doesn't necessarily have to involve a product. It could be someone could ask a question in philosophy, or someone could ask a question in spiritual matters, or it just in politics. You know, if it's a question that causes people to kind of step back and rethink the assumptions that they've been operating on, then to me it's a beautiful question.
Well, perhaps you've been asked this question before, but there are people whose profession is to ask questions. I guess I have been in that profession as a TV or radio host. Then reporters who sit there with their book and they ask questions to try to get answers for the public. Then there are therapists who put people on a couch or a chair and ask them provocative questions to kind of underlie what's going on psychologically. Scientists will say that their job in a lab is to ask the hard questions. Lawyers were told that, oh, there's a great prosecutor, Mr. Mueller, and he'll always ask the tough question. Don't think he doesn't know exactly the line of questioning. So tell us, are any of these better examples one to the other, or do you think they're all different kinds of questioners?
I think they're all different, and I think they're using questioning in different ways. You know, interestingly, you know, if you think about the way a prosecutor or a lawyer uses questions, they're using questions to try to get, oftentimes to try to get specific answers that they have in mind, right? Mm-hmm. Journalists sometimes do that too. Journalists sometimes will ask a question with kind of knowing what the answer is they want to get, right? And so they're using the question to get that answer. Now, there are other people who use questions without any idea about what the answer might be. And they're using it, I would say, almost in an exploratory way, right? They're using questions like an innovator or a philosopher, perhaps, or someone who is interested in new ideas. They may be raising and asking questions where they have no idea what the answer is. They're really curious. Mm. They want to find out. So it's interesting how professional questioners will use questions in different ways. But what they all have in common is they all understand at least some aspect of the power of questioning. The psychologist or the psychiatrist understands the power of questioning to sort of unlock things in someone's mind, right? The journalist understands the power of questioning to extract information from people. Right. Mm-hmm. So they all understand some different aspect of the power of questioning. I tend to look at this holistically. Right. And so I'm looking at all the different powers and I'm sort of, putting them side by side and pointing out to people, hey, not only does questioning do this, but it also does that. And it does this and it does that. And a lot of times when I talk to one of these professional questioners, it's funny, they only think about the one aspect, you know, like when I talk to journalists about questioning, all they think about is, yeah, questioning is great for getting information out of people. Yeah, it's great for eliciting information out of people. And I say to them, well, that's only part of it. You know, that's the way you're using questioning. But, you know, if I could show you an innovator who's using questioning in a whole different way. He's not using it to pull information out of people. He's using it to open up his own thinking and get new ideas. So it's really interesting when you look at side by side all the different things that questioning can do.
Absolutely. What has Alexa, Siri, or Google done to the world of questioning? Because sometimes now when you automate it and do it by artificial intelligence, you're really limiting very precisely the focus of a question.
Yeah, I mean, there's two schools of thought on this, on what this technology is doing to curiosity and to our ability to question. There are people who think it's a negative thing, and there are people who think it's a positive. It's a tremendous tool. I'm right in the middle. I think it's both. You know, I think that the negative part of it is that we tend to accept those answers coming from Google and Siri maybe as the end all, the be all and end all answers. And we've asked the question, we've gotten this quick answer, and that's all we need to know. And that's a negative, because obviously there's so much more that we, if we're curious about something and we're interested, we really should be exploring it way beyond one quick Google search. There's so much more information out there. The information we're getting from Google may not even be the best information, you know. So I think if we become too dependent on those quick answers that come from Google, it's a bad thing. It also, I have seen researchers on curiosity say that it might be hurting our curiosity because we get the answers too easily and too quickly, and our curiosity doesn't have a chance to build and grow. So those are a couple of negatives. Now, I'll give you a couple of positives. A couple of positives are when a question comes up in your mind now, you have some place to get started right away on it. If you want to explore a question now, You have the means to start exploring right away, and you can start with Google. You know, all I would say is don't end there. You know, use that as your launching point. Use that as your first step that might lead you to some other resources and some other possibilities. But it's a great tool to have because it helps us kind of, you know, take the first steps of doing, of answering our questions and working on our questions.
You also talk about how to be a good questioner, and a good questioner pays close attention to the world around them. You don't assume or accept. You dig deep. You use your imagination. So for somebody who said, well, I'm not that inquisitive, I mean, what do you say about how important it is to develop a curiosity and an ability to really get deeper into a topic?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, when people say I'm not really that inquisitive or curious, I think it's just because they haven't really exercised it. I think we all have that. You know, we're born as with curiosity. We're almost born asking questions. We're doing it by the time we're 2 or 3 years old. So I think it's there in all of us. And in fact, you know, some of the research on curiosity has indicated that, you know, curiosity it's not a trait; it's a state. And so by that I mean, you know, it's not something that's either in you or not. It's there, but it's there's a state you're in that will either bring it out or not bring it out. There's a mindset or maybe an environment you're in that is either conducive to creativity and curiosity or it's not. So I think the issue for people is, you know, to try to change the mindset and maybe the environment a little bit if you want your curiosity to flourish more. Try to give yourself more time for exploration. You know, try to almost convince yourself that it's worth taking the time to slow down, think more, pay attention more to what's going on around you, be willing to ask questions, be willing to explore questions, take ownership of questions. All of that stuff takes a little bit of time and effort. We can all do it, but you have to be willing to do it. You have to be willing to invest a little bit of your brain power and your time. And I think a lot of us will do that if we think it's worth it. So maybe the first thing you have to convince yourself of is that it's worth it. It's worth it to be a curious, questioning person. It's worth the effort. And that's part of what I talk about a lot in my books. Why is it worth it? Well, it's worth it because it's gonna help you connect with other people better. It's going to make you a more interesting person. It may help you with your career. If you're in Silicon Valley, it may help you make $1 billion. You know, there's a lot of different payoffs that come with it. So once you recognize that there's a lot of payoffs, then maybe you're more likely to invest in it.
Absolutely. And you remind us there's a nonprofit called the Right Question Institute that studies questioning and devises question formulation exercises for schools. And in this wonderful new book that Warren Berger has put out, he will answer questions like, what are the 5 enemies of questioning? And why should you make your mission statement a question as opposed to a statement? All
yeah.
kinds of things in the book of beautiful questions. And I love the question that Daniel Pink, and I did a PBS special with Daniel Pink many years ago, and his question is, what's stopping you from picking up this extraordinary book by Warren Berger, The Book of Beautiful Questions? And thank you so much, Warren. I don't know why it's taken me so long to invite you on America Trends.
Well, that's a great question. but I was glad to be on and loved our conversation. And by the way, your questions were great.
Oh, thank you so much. Coming from you, that means something to me. Warren Berger, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.